A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what walkability actually means in urban planning. Not the casual, I can stroll to a coffee shop version, but the technical definition planners use. What makes a neighborhood walkable? What are the criteria? And why does the term get thrown around so loosely in real estate listings?
Oh, this is one of my favorite topics. And you're right to flag the real estate problem. Walkable has become one of those words that means everything and therefore nothing. I saw a listing last week that described a house on a 6-lane arterial road as walkable because there was a gas station convenience store 800 meters away. That is not what we mean.
800 meters to buy a slushie and a lottery ticket.
So let's get into what urban planners actually mean. The core definition, and this comes straight out of the literature, walkability is the measure of how friendly an area is to walking, but it breaks down into specific, measurable components. The framework most planners use is something called the 5 Ds: density, diversity, design, destination accessibility, and distance to transit. Some researchers have expanded it to 7 Ds by adding demand management and demographics, but the 5 Ds is the standard.
5 Ds. All right, walk me through them. And I want to know which one actually matters most, because I suspect there's a hierarchy here that planning debates get wrong.
So density first. This is the most obvious one. It's residential and employment density, basically how many people live and work in a given area. The research consistently shows that you need a threshold of about 30 to 40 people per acre, or roughly 7 to 10 dwelling units per acre, for walking to become a viable transportation mode rather than just recreation. Below that, you don't have enough destinations within walking distance to make it practical.
This is where the American suburb fundamentally breaks, right? Single-family zoning at 2 or 3 units per acre. You're never going to hit that threshold.
And it's not just about having people. It's about having enough people to support the commercial and civic destinations that make walking worthwhile. A corner store needs a certain customer base within walking distance to survive. If your density is too low, the store never appears, and then there's nothing to walk to. It's a chicken and egg problem that density solves.
Density is the foundation. What's the second D?
Diversity. And this is land use diversity, not demographic diversity, though they often correlate. The idea is mixed use development. You want residential, commercial, office, and civic uses intermingled rather than separated into single use zones. The classic planning metric here is the jobs housing balance. If everyone has to leave the neighborhood to work and no one comes into work, you've created a commuter shed, not a walkable place.
This is the Euclidean zoning problem, isn't it? The whole idea from the 1920s that you separate uses because factories were noisy and polluting, and then we just kept doing it for everything.
That's exactly the history. And the Supreme Court case was Village of Euclid versus Ambler Realty in 1926, which upheld the constitutionality of single-use zoning. The original rationale made some sense. You don't want a tannery next to a school. But we applied the logic universally long after heavy industry stopped being the main concern and created these vast monocultures of housing with nothing else in them.
You've got density. You've got diversity.
This is the one that people actually feel when they're walking, even if they can't articulate it. Design covers the built environment at the pedestrian scale. Block size, street connectivity, sidewalk quality, building setbacks, street trees, lighting, the presence of windows and doors facing the street rather than blank walls.
Block size is a bigger deal than most people realize, right?
The research on this is really clear. In a study of 24 California cities, shorter blocks were consistently associated with more walking. The ideal block length for walkability is about 200 to 400 feet, roughly 60 to 120 meters. Once you get above 600 feet, walking trips drop off significantly because the pedestrian network becomes too coarse. If you have to walk 3 blocks out of your way just across the street, you're not going to walk.
This connects to street connectivity. The grid versus the cul-de-sac.
Connectivity is measured by intersection density, how many intersections per square mile or per square kilometer. A highly walkable area might have 200 to 300 intersections per square mile. A typical suburban subdivision might have 30 or 40 because everything feeds into collector roads and cul-de-sacs. The cul-de-sac was designed to eliminate through traffic, which it does, but it also eliminates through walking. You can't get anywhere without going the long way around.
Jeff Speck talks about this a lot, doesn't he? I remember reading his general theory of walkability.
Yes. Speck's framework is elegant because it distills everything into four conditions. For a walk to happen, it has to be useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting. Useful means you have destinations. That's density and diversity. Safe means you're not going to get hit by a car. That's design, especially street design and crossing infrastructure. Comfortable means the street feels like an outdoor room. Buildings framing the space, not exposed parking lots. Interesting means there are signs of human activity, storefronts, people, variety.
The interesting piece is underrated. I've walked through neighborhoods that technically check all the other boxes but feel dead, and you just want the walk to end.
That's what Jane Jacobs called the intricate ballet of the sidewalk. The idea that a good street has constant small interactions, people coming and going, shopkeepers sweeping, kids playing, old people watching. It's not just infrastructure, it's the life that infrastructure enables. And Speck's point is that interesting isn't a bonus, it's a requirement. If a walk is boring, people won't choose it twice.
We've covered density, diversity, design.
This is about the regional scale accessibility of the neighborhood. How connected is it to the broader metropolitan area's jobs, services, and amenities? You can have a perfectly designed neighborhood internally, but if it takes 45 minutes to get to the central business district or the major employment centers, it's an island. This is where the distinction between neighborhood walkability and regional accessibility matters.
Right. You can walk to your corner store, but still be car dependent for everything that pays your mortgage.
And this is why location within the metro area matters so much. A walkable neighborhood in the urban core has fundamentally different characteristics from a walkable neighborhood on the fringe, even if their internal design is similar. The core neighborhood connects to the region. The fringe neighborhood is self-contained in a way that limits opportunity.
The fifth D.
Distance to transit. This is straightforward. How close is the nearest high-quality transit stop? The rule of thumb in transit planning is that people will walk about a quarter mile, roughly 400 meters, to a bus stop, and up to half a mile, about 800 meters, to a rail station. If your walkable neighborhood doesn't connect to transit, you've created a walkable enclave that still requires car ownership, which undermines the whole point for a lot of people.
Walkability isn't just about walking, it's about the walking transit nexus. The walk is the first mile and the last mile.
And this is where a lot of walkable new developments fail. They build a nice main street with apartments above retail, but it's in the middle of a sea of parking, disconnected from any transit network, and the only way to get there is by car. You've built a walkable destination that's only accessible by driving. It's a Potemkin village of urbanism.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, the safety piece. Because when most people think about walkability, they think about sidewalks and crosswalks, the literal pedestrian infrastructure. But my sense is that traffic speed is the thing that actually matters most for safety, not whether there's a painted line on the ground.
You're completely right, and the data on this is stark. The risk of pedestrian fatality rises exponentially with vehicle speed. At 20 miles per hour, about 32 kilometers per hour, a pedestrian hit by a car has roughly a 90% chance of survival. At 30 miles per hour, it drops to about 60%. At 40 miles per hour, it's about 20% survival. Speed is the difference between a broken leg and a funeral.
20% survival at 40 miles an hour. That should be on every speed limit sign.
And this is why street design matters more than speed limits. You can post a 25 mile per hour sign on a street that's designed like a highway. Wide lanes, no trees, long sight lines, and people will drive 45 because the design tells them it's safe to do so. The term in traffic engineering is design speed, and it overrides posted speed every time.
The fix isn't lower speed limits, it's narrower lanes, tighter corners, street trees that create visual friction.
Yes, traffic calming through design, chicanes, raised crosswalks, curb extensions, road diets that reduce four lanes to three with a center turn lane. All of these physically constrain speed in ways that signs cannot. The most effective pedestrian safety intervention isn't a crosswalk. It's making the street feel like a place where cars should go slowly.
Let's talk about the road diet specifically, because I know this has been controversial in a lot of American cities. You take a four-lane arterial and convert it to three lanes, one in each direction plus a center turn lane. Drivers lose their minds, but the safety data is compelling.
Compelling is an understatement. The Federal Highway Administration has documented crash reductions of 19-47% after road diet conversions. And the key finding is that these reductions come with minimal impact on traffic volume. Typically, a road diet can handle up to about 20,000 vehicles per day without significant congestion. Above that, you might need to keep four lanes. But below that threshold, the extra lanes were never necessary. They were just inducing speeding.
You gain space for bike lanes or wider sidewalks or street trees. All the stuff that makes the street more walkable.
The road diet is a perfect example of what planners mean by complete streets. Streets designed for all users, not just cars. A complete street has safe infrastructure for pedestrians, cyclists, transit riders, and drivers. It's not anti-car, it's pro-everyone.
I want to poke at something in the walkability discussion that I think gets glossed over. We've been talking about walkability as an objective set of metrics. Density, diversity, design, destination access, transit proximity. But there's a subjective dimension too. The same street can feel walkable to me and unwalkable to someone with a stroller or a wheelchair or a visual impairment.
This is a crucial point, and the planning profession has been slow to address it. The standard walkability metrics are based on the experience of an able-bodied adult. But if you're pushing a stroller, a cracked sidewalk isn't a minor inconvenience, it's a barrier. If you're in a wheelchair, a curb without a ramp isn't an obstacle, it's a wall. The concept here is universal design. The idea that public space should be accessible to everyone, regardless of age or ability.
This is where the maintenance piece comes in, which is the least glamorous part of walkability and probably the most neglected. You can design a perfect pedestrian network, but if the city doesn't maintain the sidewalks, clear the snow, fix the lights, trim the trees, it degrades.
Maintenance is the unsexy foundation of everything. Jane Jacobs wrote about this, the importance of eyes on the street, but also just the basic upkeep that signals a place is cared for. A street with broken lights and overgrown sidewalks tells you, at a visceral level, that no one is responsible for this space, and that perception of neglect undermines the feeling of safety that's essential for walkability.
There's a phrase I've heard you use, the walking shed. What's that?
The walking shed, or pedestrian catchment area, is the area within a 5 or 10 minute walk of a given point, typically a transit stop or a commercial center. It's usually mapped as a circle with a quarter mile or half mile radius, but good planners map it based on the actual pedestrian network, not as the crow flies distance. Because if there's a highway or a river or a superblock in the way, that circle shrinks dramatically.
It's the difference between 500 meters as the crow flies and 500 meters of actual walking path.
And this is where connectivity comes back in. A neighborhood with a fine-grained grid has a much larger walking shed than a neighborhood with cul-de-sacs and circuitous paths, even if they're the same physical distance from the destination. The grid gives you options. The cul-de-sac gives you one long route.
Let's talk about what walkability is not, because I think the misconceptions are as interesting as the definition. Walkability is not the same as pedestrian infrastructure. You can have perfect sidewalks on a strode, and it's still unwalkable because there's nowhere to go, and the experience is miserable.
The strode. This is the term from Strong Towns, right? A street-road hybrid that fails at being either. A street is a place. It's a destination. It has buildings facing it. It's designed for low speeds and human interaction. A road is a connection between places. High speed, limited access, designed for throughput. A strode tries to do both and achieves neither. Fast traffic mixed with driveways and strip malls, dangerous for drivers and pedestrians alike.
The strode is the default development pattern for huge swaths of North America. It's what you get when you zone for commercial along an arterial and let developers build whatever.
And here's the thing about strodes. They're often technically walkable by the checklist. There might be sidewalks. There might be crosswalks. The distance to destinations might be short. But no one walks there because the experience is so hostile. You're walking next to 50-mile-per-hour traffic, crossing 6 lanes at a light that takes 2 minutes to change, breathing exhaust the whole time. That's not walkability. That's a pedestrian endurance challenge.
The checklist approach fails. You can't just count sidewalks and crosswalks and declare victory.
You can't. And this is where SPEC's comfortable and interesting criteria become essential. A walkable street needs enclosure, buildings that define the space, not parking lots that dissolve it. The ideal ratio is a street width to building height of about 1:1 or 1:1.5. That creates the feeling of an outdoor room. When the ratio gets wider, when buildings are set back behind parking, when the street is 6 lanes, the sense of enclosure vanishes, and with it, the sense of comfort.
This is why old European city centers feel so good to walk in. Narrow streets, buildings right up to the sidewalk, consistent height.
Those weren't designed for walkability. They were designed before cars existed. Walkability was the default for most of human history. We didn't invent walkable design in the 20th century. We invented car-dependent design and then spent decades trying to retrofit walkability back into places that had lost it.
That's a useful framing. Walkability isn't an innovation. It's a restoration.
And the restoration is hard because we've baked car dependency into our zoning codes, our financing mechanisms, our infrastructure standards, our parking requirements. Every one of those systems pushes against walkability.
Let's get into parking specifically, because minimum parking requirements are one of those invisible forces that shape everything.
Parking minimums might be the single most destructive policy for walkability in North America. The basic problem is that cities require developers to provide a certain number of off-street parking spaces per unit or per square foot of commercial space, and these requirements are almost always wildly excessive. A typical requirement might be 1.5 or 2 parking spaces per residential unit, which means for every apartment you're building space for 2 cars, space that could have been housing, or a courtyard, or a retail space.
The parking has to go somewhere, so you end up with a building surrounded by a moat of asphalt.
Which destroys the street wall, pushes buildings back from the sidewalk, and creates dead zones that make walking unpleasant. And here's the kicker. The parking minimums are usually based on suburban standards applied uniformly, so even in dense urban areas with good transit, you're still required to build parking as if everyone will drive. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You mandate car infrastructure, which makes driving easier and walking harder, which increases driving, which is then used to justify the parking mandates.
There's been movement on this, right? Cities eliminating parking minimums?
A lot of movement. Buffalo became the first major U.S. city to eliminate parking minimums citywide in 2017. San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Austin all have eliminated or dramatically reduced parking minimums, especially near transit. California eliminated parking minimums near transit statewide. It's one of the most significant planning reforms happening right now, and it's directly tied to walkability.
Because if you don't have to store 2 cars, the building can meet the street, and suddenly you have a continuous street wall, ground floor retail, people walking.
The economic shift, too. Parking is expensive to build, something like $30,000 to $50,000 per space in a structured garage. That cost gets passed through to rent, which means parking mandates effectively force everyone to pay for car storage, whether they own a car or not. Eliminating those mandates makes housing cheaper and walkability easier.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about the 5 Ds. You said some researchers have expanded it to 7 Ds. What are the extra 2?
Demand management and demographics. Demand management is about parking pricing, congestion pricing, transportation demand management programs. Basically, policies that make driving reflect its true cost. If parking is free and abundant, people drive. If parking is priced at market rate, people make different choices. Demographics is about who lives in the area, age, income, household size, car ownership rates, because different populations have different travel behaviors regardless of the built environment.
Demographics is acknowledging that walkability isn't purely physical. It's also about who's doing the walking and what their needs are.
An area full of young singles might show high walking rates even with mediocre design because that demographic walks more. An area full of families with young children might show lower walking rates even with excellent design because the logistics of moving small humans are different. The physical environment matters enormously, but it's not destiny.
This connects to something I've been thinking about, The difference between walkability as a planning metric and walkability as a lived experience. A neighborhood can score well on walk score, which is an algorithm, not a human experience, and still feel hostile to walking.
Walk score is interesting and useful, but limited. It measures proximity to amenities. How close are the nearest grocery store, school, park, restaurant? It doesn't measure whether the route to those amenities is pleasant or safe. It's a destination accessibility metric masquerading as a comprehensive walkability metric. A house next to a Walmart scores well on walk score because there's a grocery store nearby, even if you have to cross a 6-lane arterial with no crosswalk to get there.
Walk score captures one of the 5 D's, destination accessibility, and misses the other 4.
It's a useful starting point, but it's not a substitute for actually walking the neighborhood and seeing how it feels.
Let's talk about what walkability enables, because I think the knock-on effect are where this gets really interesting. Walkable neighborhoods are correlated with better health outcomes, lower obesity rates, lower carbon emissions, higher property values, more social interaction, more local economic activity. The list is long.
The health connection is well documented. A study in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine found that people in walkable neighborhoods get about 35 to 45 more minutes of physical activity per week than people in car-dependent neighborhoods. That's not huge, but it's consistent, and it accumulates over a lifetime. And it's not gym exercise, it's just the incidental walking of daily life.
Incidental walking, that's the key phrase. You're not walking for exercise, you're walking because that's how you get places.
And that's sustainable in a way that gym memberships are not. You don't need willpower to walk to the store if the store is a pleasant 5-minute walk away. It just happens.
The social interaction piece is under-discussed. There's research showing that people in walkable neighborhoods know their neighbors better, have more social ties, report higher levels of trust.
This goes back to Jane Jacobs and the idea of repeated, low-stakes interactions. When you walk to the store, you see the same shopkeeper, the same neighbors, the same kids playing. Those micro-interactions accumulate into social capital. When you drive, you go from your garage to a parking lot and back. You might never see a neighbor.
The economic piece. Walkable neighborhoods tend to have higher property values per square foot. There's a premium people are willing to pay.
A study by CEOs for Cities found that a 1-point increase in walk score was associated with a $700 to $3,000 increase in home value, depending on the metro area. In the strongest markets, the walkability premium can be 30 to 50% per square foot compared to otherwise similar car-dependent properties.
Which creates an equity problem, doesn't it? If walkability commands a premium, then walkable neighborhoods become expensive, and the people who might benefit most from walkability, lower-income households that spend a larger share of income on transportation, get priced out.
This is the gentrification and walkability tension. Building walkable neighborhoods is good, but if you only build them in high-demand areas and don't build enough of them, they become luxury goods. The solution isn't to stop building walkable places. It's to build a lot more of them and to include affordable housing within them, so walkability isn't a scarce amenity.
Supply and demand applies to urban design.
It applies to everything. The reason walkable neighborhoods are expensive isn't that walkability is inherently costly. It's that we've made it illegal to build walkable neighborhoods in most of the country, so the existing supply is tiny relative to demand.
Illegal to build walkable neighborhoods. That's a strong claim, but I think you can back it up.
Single-use zoning makes mixed-use development illegal in most residential zones. Minimum parking requirements make dense, pedestrian-oriented development financially infeasible or physically impossible. Setback requirements push buildings away from the street. Minimum lot sizes prevent the fine-grained development pattern that creates interesting streetscapes. Height limits cap density below the threshold needed to support transit. Every one of these rules individually seems reasonable. Together, they make it illegal to build anything that looks like a traditional walkable neighborhood.
The zoning code is a cookbook for car dependency.
It's not even subtle. The zoning code was written, in many cases explicitly, to separate uses, reduce density, and accommodate the automobile. The fact that it produces car-dependent places isn't a bug. It was the design intent.
Reforming it is politically brutal because every piece of it has a constituency. Homeowners who don't want an apartment building next door. Drivers who don't want to pay for parking. Developers who've optimized for the current rules.
the politics of zoning reform are the hardest part of this entire conversation. You can have perfect technical knowledge about what makes a neighborhood walkable, and none of it matters if you can't change the rules. This is why the YIMBY movement, yes, in my backyard, has been so important. It's a political coalition organized around the idea that building more housing in more places at more densities is good policy.
YIMBY versus NIMBY is fundamentally a debate about walkability, even if neither side frames it that way.
When someone opposes an apartment building because it will change the character of the neighborhood, what they're often defending, whether they realize it or not, is a car-dependent development pattern. The character is low-density, single-use, and auto-oriented. Adding housing, adding people, adding destinations, that's what creates walkability.
I want to ask you about a specific case that I think illustrates a lot of these tensions. The 15-minute city concept. It's become a flashpoint.
The 15-minute city is essentially walkability rebranded for a broader audience. The idea, developed by Carlos Moreno and popularized by Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo, is that all essential needs, work, shopping, education, healthcare, leisure, should be accessible within a 15-minute walk or bike ride from home. It's walkability plus proximity to services, packaged as a comprehensive urban vision.
It's been bizarrely controversial. There's a whole conspiracy theory that 15-minute cities are a plot to restrict movement and trap people in open-air prisons,
which is completely disconnected from what the concept actually proposes. The 15-minute city is about expanding choice, giving people the option to meet their needs locally rather than being forced to drive long distances. It's the opposite of restriction, but it's become a culture war flashpoint because it challenges the primacy of the car, and for some people, the car is identity, not just transportation.
The car is identity is something planners consistently underestimate. It's not just a tool. It's freedom, it's autonomy, it's adulthood, it's American. Telling someone their neighborhood should be less car-dependent, Kaland is telling them they should be less free.
I think the better framing, which some advocates have adopted, is that car dependency isn't freedom, it's a different kind of constraint. If you can't leave your house without a 2-ton machine, if your teenager can't get anywhere without being driven, if your aging parent has to give up their independence when they give up their keys, that's not freedom either. Walkability, transit, bike infrastructure, these give people options. Options are freedom.
That's a much better message than cars bad, walking good. But I suspect it's still a hard sell in places where the built environment makes walking impractical and driving is the only viable option.
And that's why the political strategy that's emerged, especially through strong towns and similar organizations, focuses on incremental change. You don't try to turn a suburb into Manhattan overnight. You legalize accessory dwelling units, you allow corner stores in residential zones, you do a road diet on one arterial, you eliminate parking minimums, small changes that compound.
Incrementalism as a strategy for walkability. I like that. It acknowledges that you can't rebuild the country, but you can make 1,000 small decisions that add up.
That's actually how walkable neighborhoods were built historically, incrementally over decades, by many small actors making independent decisions within a permissive framework. The master-planned approach to walkability, where you build a whole urban village from scratch, almost never works as well, because it lacks the organic variety and adaptation that makes real places interesting.
The interesting criterion again. You can't plan interesting. It has to emerge.
You can plan the conditions for interesting. You can provide the framework, small lots, mixed uses, good streets, public spaces, but the life that fills it has to grow on its own.
All right, so we've covered the 5 D's, specs for conditions, the difference between walkability metrics and walkability experience, the policy barriers, the politics. If you had to give someone a practical checklist for evaluating whether a neighborhood is actually walkable, not just looking at walk score, but really assessing it, what would you tell them?
I'd say walk the neighborhood at different times of day and ask yourself 5 questions. 1. Can I get to daily needs without a car? Groceries, pharmacy, a place to eat, a park. 2. Do I feel safe crossing the streets? Not just are there crosswalks, but do drivers actually yield? 3. Is the walk pleasant, or am I counting the minutes until it's over? Trees, interesting buildings, other people. 4. Would my least mobile friend or family member be able to navigate this? Stairs, curb cuts, sidewalk width, places to rest, and 5. Does the street feel like a place or a conduit? Are buildings facing the street? Are there windows and doors? Or is it blank walls and parking lots?
That's a solid list. I'd add a sixth. Can a kid walk to school or a park safely? Because if a neighborhood passes the kid test, it passes every test.
The kid test is the ultimate walkability metric. Children are the most vulnerable pedestrians. They're small, they're unpredictable, they have poor judgment about traffic. If a street is safe enough for an 8-year-old to walk alone, it's safe enough for everyone. And if it's not, the street has failed.
Which brings us back to speed. The difference between a street where kids can walk and a street where they can't is usually about 15 miles per hour of vehicle speed.
Speed is everything. Everything else, sidewalks, crosswalks, signals, is secondary. If cars are moving slowly, pedestrians are safe. If cars are moving fast, pedestrians are in danger, no matter how good the infrastructure looks on paper.
The simplest walkability intervention is also the hardest politically. Slow the cars down.
The best way to slow cars down isn't enforcement, it's design. Build streets that make speeding feel wrong. Narrow lanes, tight corners, trees close to the curb, frequent crossings. The street should communicate, through its physical form, that this is a place for people, not a thoroughfare for vehicles.
I think that's a good place to land. Walkability isn't a checklist, it's not a score, it's not a marketing term. It's the cumulative result of 1,000 design decisions that add up to a place where walking feels natural, safe, and worthwhile. And we've spent the better part of a century making those decisions in the wrong direction.
The good news is that the direction is starting to shift. The reform's happening now. Parking minimums, zoning changes, complete streets policies, road diets are all pushing toward walkability. It's slow, it's contested, it's uneven. But it's movement.
Movement toward movement. There's a nice symmetry there.
I walked right into that. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, a Jesuit missionary in Guyana recorded that Aztec descendants playing patolli would intentionally miscount their scores when losing to a family member, but never when losing to a stranger. A behavioral anomaly suggesting the game served as a covert wealth redistribution mechanism within kinship networks.
They were throwing the game to slide resources to family. Ancient point shaving.
Some things never change. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop and to Daniel for the prompt. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We'll be back soon.
Walk carefully out there.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.